So tonight we are going to finish the can you hear me okay, Larry?
My shirt. Yes, I can.
Okay, great. Tonight we're going to finish As a Man Thinketh by James Allen. And the last chapter is titled Serenity, and it's only 3 pages. So we're going to get a little bonus, and we're going to read from another one of his books called The Path to Prosperity. And this first chapter is called The Secret of Health, Success, and Power. And with that thought in mind, please pray with me. Oh, Heavenly Father,
Oh, Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
Divine Mother,
Divine Mother,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Blessed Master,
Blessed Master,
Dearest Mother,
Dearest Mother,
Beloved David,
Beloved David,
Saints and sages of all religions,
Saints and Sages of all
I bow
religions,
to you all.
I bow to you
Free
all.
my life from all obstacles
Free my life from all
and give
obstacles.
me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual
Make
development.
my mind thy temple.
Make my mind thy
Make
temple.
my heart thy altar.
Make my heart thy
Make
altar.
my love thy home.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only king,
Be thou the only
reigning
king,
on the throne of my consciousness.
reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Oh. Peace, bliss, amen. I want to tell you, if you haven't been here for some of our other sessions with this Western master, I wanted to tell you a little bit about his life and how I got turned on to James Allen. And David actually did a little course on this very book, on James Allen's book. And David, and this was quite a many years ago, and you may have forgotten it or might not have been exposed to it. And David had a tremendous amount of respect for him. And the reason is because the truths that he espouses are universal. And we're steeped in the teachings of David and Mother and Master. And one of the things that they say, and one of the things it says in the Bible, when Christ comes into Jerusalem and his followers are singing his praises and they're very overjoyed to see him. And someone says, "Can't you quiet them down? Can't you silence them? This is a big distraction." And Jesus says something to the effect that even if you were to silence them, the very rocks and the stones would rise up and espouse these truths. And the idea there is that these truths are universal. And it doesn't matter if there is no one to teach them or if there is no book to read out of. An introspective spiritual aspirant will discover these truths on their own. And I think that was one of the fascinations David had with James Allen, is that James Allen is not the product of some Eastern guru or a Western religion. These are all observations that he made in his own life, and he came to these conclusions through self-testing and through observation and seeing what actually works to bring us closer to the divine and in higher conscious and towards happiness. So before we start on this last little bit of his book here, I want to tell you just a little bit about his life. So he was born in 1864, so right there in the Victorian era. And at the age of 15, his father lost his job and went to America, to New York City, to try and find a better path for their family, to try and find some prosperity. Unfortunately, on his second day there, he was robbed and murdered. And James was at the age of 15. He was the oldest of two brothers. He now had to leave school and find work. And for much of the 1890s, he worked as a private secretary, kind of like an administrative assistant to different British manufacturing firms. And he eventually moved to South Wales, and he earned his living through journalism and reporting. And there is where he met his wife. And finally, in 1898, he found an occupation in which he could showcase his spiritual and social interests as the writer for the magazine The Herald of the Golden Age. And Allen entered into a creative period where he published the first of his many books. And his first book was in 1901, From Poverty to Power. Now, we're used to hearing titles like this today in the entire self-help industry. But that didn't exist in James Allen's time. This idea that we had power over our circumstances through our thinking and through our beliefs. And he was the motivation and the original inspiration for many works that came later, like Norman Vincent Peale's The Power of Positive Thinking. And in 1902, he began to publish his own spiritual magazine, The Light of Reason. And he later retitled that The Epoch. And in 1903, Allen published his third and most famous book, As a Man Thinketh. And this title is loosely based on the biblical passage of Proverbs in 23:7, as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. And so this small work, it's not real long. We've just read it in these last two sessions and just going to finish it tonight. It eventually became read around the world and brought Allen enough money for him to be able to quit his secretarial work and pursue his writing and editing career full time. So in 1903, he and his wife retired to the small coastal town in southwest England of Ilfracombe, where Allen spent the rest of his life. And he continued to publish the Epoch, and he produced 19 books through 1902 in 10 years to 1912. And he produced 19 works and died at a fairly young age, at about 47, 48 years old, from tuberculosis. But he left this huge creative collection of works and thought, very high-minded. And when he retired to this little stone cottage on the coast, his day began with a pre-dawn walk up the Carn, which is a stony spot on a hillside overlooking his home and the sea. And he would remain there in meditation for an hour or more. And then he would return to the house and spend the morning writing. And the afternoons were devoted to gardening, a pastime he very much enjoyed. And his evenings were spent in conversation with those who were interested in his work. So we have a lifestyle that's very much like a guru. Here he meditated, he focused his mind on God, on peaceful thoughts, and then he would discourse in the evening. And a friend described Allen as a frail-looking little man, Christ-like, with a mass of flowing black hair. He says, "I think of him especially in the black velvet suit he always wore in the evenings," his friend wrote. "He would talk quietly to a small group of us then, English, French, Austrian, and Indian, of meditation, of philosophy, of Tolstoy and Buddha, and of killing nothing, not even a mouse in the garden." So here it was, the very early years of the 20th century, 1903 or so. And he focused on meditation, contemplation, living a high-minded life, high thinking and simple living, as Master suggested. And he was also, back then in those days, a vegetarian, something almost unheard of in that era. And his friend says he overawed us all a little because of his appearance, his gentle conversation, and especially because he went out to commune with God on the hills before dawn. And Alan says we become spiritually rich when we discover the adventure within, when we are conscious of the oneness of all life, when we know the power of meditation, when we experience kinship with nature. And with that, we're going to read a little bit from this extra bonus from The Path to Prosperity. And this section, this chapter, is titled The Secret of Success, of Health, Success, and Power. We all remember with what delight as children we listened to the never-tiring fairy tale, how eagerly we followed the fluctuating fortunes of the good boy or girl, ever protected in the hour of crisis from the evil machinations of the scheming witch, the cruel giant, or the wicked hag. And our little hearts never faltered for the fate of the hero or heroine, nor did we doubt their ultimate triumph over all their enemies, for we knew that the fairies were infallible, and they would never desert those who had concentrated themselves to the good and the true. And what unspeakable joy within us, pulsated within us when the fairy queen, bringing all her magic to bear at the critical moment, scattered all the darkness and trouble and granted them the complete satisfaction of all their hopes, and they were happy, happy ever after. With the accumulating years and an ever-increasing intimacy with the so-called realities of life, our beautiful fairy world became obliterated, and its wonderful inhabitants were regulated in the archives of memory to the shadowy and unreal. And we thought we were wise and strong, and thus leaving forever the land of childish dreams. But as we become little children in the wondrous world of wisdom, we shall return again to the inspiring dreams of childhood, and find that they are, after all, realities. So as we listen to his writings, I want you to imagine two things. One, that we're in James Allen's little cottage, little stone cottage with a fire in the fireplace, and we're gathered around, and he's discoursing these ideas to us personally. And the other thing I want you to think about is the parallels between what we've been taught by our spiritual masters, by our God-realized masters, and the ideas that James Allen is putting forth here, and start thinking about the parallels. Because great truth is great truth, no matter where it may be found. And it's interesting when those go seeking with a critical mind and with observation and want to discover these truths for themselves, how they all come to very similar conclusions. So the fairy folk, so small and nearly always invisible, yet possessed of an all-conquering and magical power, who bestow upon the good, health, wealth, and happiness, along with the gifts of nature in lavish profusion, start again into reality and become immortalized in the soul realm of him who, by growth and wisdom, has entered into knowledge of the power of thought and the laws which govern the inner world of being. To him, the fairies live again as thought people, thought messengers, thought powers, in working harmony with the overruling good. And he has good capitalized. So we're talking about God, the good of God. And they who, day by day, endeavor to harmonize their hearts with the heart of the supreme good, do in reality acquire true wealth and happiness. The power of goodness. There is no protection to compare with goodness. And by goodness, I do not mean a mere outward conformity to the rules of morality. I mean pure thought, noble inspiration, unselfish love, and freedom from vainglory. To dwell continually in good thoughts is to throw around oneself a psychic atmosphere of sweetness and power, which leaves its impress upon all who come in contact with it. As the rising sun puts to rout the helpless shadows, so are all the important forces of evil put to flight by the searching rays of positive thought, which shine forth from a heart made strong in purity and faith. Where there is sterling faith and uncompromising purity, there is health, there is success, there is power. In such a one, disease, failure, and disaster can find no lodging, for there is nothing on which they can feed. Disease begins in the mind. Even physical conditions are largely determined by mental states, and to this truth the scientific world is rapidly being drawn. An old materialistic belief that we are what our body makes us is rapidly passing away and is being replaced by the inspiring belief that we are superior to our body and that our body is what we make it by the power of thought. People everywhere are ceasing to believe that a person is despairing because they are ill and are coming to understand that they are ill because they are despairing. And in the near future, the fact that all disease has its origin in the mind will become common knowledge. There is no evil in the universe, but has its root and origin in the mind. And sin, sickness, sorrow, and affliction do not in reality belong to the universal order, are not inherent in the nature of things, but are the distinct outcome of our ignorance of the right relations to things. According to tradition, there once lived in India a school of philosophers who led a life of such absolute purity and simplicity that they commonly reached the age of 150 years, and to fall sick was looked upon by them as an unpardonable disgrace, for it was considered to indicate a violation of law. The sooner we realize and acknowledge that sickness, far from being the arbitrary visitation of an offended God, or the test of an unwise providence, is the result of our own error or sin, the sooner shall we enter upon the highway of health. Disease comes to those who attract it, to those whose minds and bodies are receptive to it, and flees from those whose strong, pure, and positive thought sphere generates healing and life-giving currents. If you are given to anger, worry, jealousy, greed, or any other inharmonious state of mind and expect perfect physical health, you are expecting the impossible, for you are continually sowing the seeds of disease in your mind. Such conditions of mind are carefully shunned by the wise one, for he or she knows them to be far more dangerous than a bad drain or an infected house. If you would be free from all physical aches and pains and would enjoy perfect physical harmony, then put your mind in order and harmonize your thoughts. Think joyful thoughts. Think loving thoughts. Allow the elixir of goodwill to flow through your veins, and you will need no other medicine. Put away your jealousies, your suspicions, your worries, your hatreds, your self-indulgence, and you will put away your illness, your fatigue, your nervousness, and aching joints. If you will persist in clinging to these debilitating and demoralizing habits of mind, then do not complain when your body is laid low with sickness. The following story illustrates the close relationship between habits of the mind and bodily conditions. A certain man was afflicted with a painful disease, and he tried one physician after another, but all to no purpose. He then visited towns which were famous for their curative waters, and after having bathed in them all, his disease was more painful than ever. One night, he dreamed that a presence came to him and said, "Brother, hast thou tried all the means of cure?" And he replied, "I've tried them all." "Nay," said the presence, "come with me, and I will show thee a healing bath which has escaped thy notice." The afflicted man followed, and the presence led him to a clear pool of water and said, "Plunge thyself into this water, and thou shalt surely recover," and thereupon vanished. The man plunged into the water, and on coming out, lo, his disease had left him, and at the same moment he saw written above the pool the word "renounce." Upon waking, the full meaning of his dream flashed across his mind, and looking within, he discovered that he had, all along, been a victim to an enervating indulgence, and he vowed that he would renounce it forever. He carried out his vow, and from that day his affliction began to leave him, and in a short time he was restored to health. Many people complain that they have broken down through overwork. In the majority of such cases, the breakdown is more frequently the result of foolishly wasted energy. If you would secure health, you must learn to work without friction. To become anxious or excited or to worry over needless details is to invite a breakdown. Work, whether of brain or body, is beneficial and health-giving, and the person who can work with a steady and calm persistency, freed from all anxiety and worry, and with their mind utterly oblivious to all but the work they have in hand, will not only accomplish far more than the person who is always hurried and anxious, but they will retain their health, a boon which the other quickly forfeits. So we know this from this state we call Sattvic. And he's actually, without using the words, he's comparing Sattvic energy, that sort of uplifted, calm energy where you can effortlessly do things, to the state of Rajasic energy, sort of that nervous energy that has to move and creates actually anxiety within us. So this is a tremendous transition where we can transition from a Rajasic energy to the Sattvic state, that uplifted calm where everything is so efficient. True health and true success go together, for they are inseparably intertwined in the thought realm. As mental harmony produces bodily health, so it also lends to a harmonious sequence in the actual working out of one's plans. Order your thoughts and you will order your life. Pour the oil of tranquility upon the turbulent waters of the passions and prejudices and the tempest of misfortune, however so they may be threatened, will be powerless to wreck the ship of your soul as it threads its way across the ocean of life, and if that ship be piloted by a cheerful and never-failing faith, its course will be doubly sure, and many perils will pass it by, which would otherwise attack it. And now he speaks of faith. Faith is a deep belief that no matter what our outward circumstances, the good things in our life will come to pass. By the power of faith, every enduring work is accomplished. Faith in the supreme, and once again he has supreme capitalized, constant references to the divine. Faith in the supreme, faith in the overruling law, faith in your work and in your power to accomplish that work. Here is the rock upon which you must build if you would achieve, if you would stand and not fail. To follow under all circumstances the highest promptings within you, to be always true to the divine self, to rely upon the inward light, the inward voice, and to pursue your purpose with a fearless and restful heart, believing that the future will yield unto you the reward of every thought and effort, knowing that the laws of the universe can never fail, and that your own will come back to you with mathematical exactitude, this faith and the living of faith. So I find this interesting because when we're on the path, we're all devotees and we focus on God, we meditate, we listen to the masters, we listen to talks, we read good things. But even within that, we have times when we question ourselves on the path. Are we making enough progress? Are we a good devotee? Are we really doing the right things? Are we operating with enough intensity, enough devotion? Are we really doing our best? And these are all doubts that creep in and very subtly impede our progress. And what James Allen is telling us here is have absolute faith that if we keep our mind on God, if we do what David and Mother and Master tell us, if we maintain our focus, our progress on the path, our closeness with God, our connection with God is assured. And even as David used to tell us about the conversation between Krishna and Arjuna, and Arjuna would have his doubts when he looked across this field and saw this opposing army. And Krishna said unto him, "Victory is assured. It is for this purpose that you were born." And he went on to tell Arjuna that all he had to do is enter the battle with faith, and victory would be his. And that's what James Allen is telling us here. Slightly different words, but the message is the same. Have faith in the path, and have faith that if your devotion is sincere, if we keep our minds on God, our progress and our ultimate victory is assured. By the power of such faith, the dark waters of uncertainty are divided, every mountain of difficulty crumbles away, and the believing soul passes on unharmed. Strive, O reader, to acquire above everything the priceless possession of this dauntless faith, for it is the talisman of happiness, of success, of peace, of power, of all that makes life great and superior to suffering. Build upon such faith, and you build upon the rock of the eternal. And with the materials of the eternal and the structure that you will erect will never be dissolved, for it will transcend all the accumulations of material luxuries and riches, the end of which is dust. Whether you are hurled into the depths of sorrow or lifted upon the heights of joy, ever retain your hold upon this faith. Ever return it as your rock of refuge, and keep your feet firmly planted upon its immortal and immovable base. Centered in such a faith, you will shatter, like so many toys of glass, all the forces of evil that are hurled against you, and you will achieve a success such as the mere striver after worldly gain can never know or even dream of. If you have faith, and doubt not, ye shall not only do this, but if ye shall say unto this mountain, "Be thou removed, and be thou cast into the sea," it shall be done. It's a little quote from the Bible. There are those today, men and women, tabernacled in flesh and blood, who have realized this faith, who live in it, and by it day by day, and who, having put it into the utmost test, have entered into the possession of its glory and peace. Such have sent out the world of command, the word of command, and the mountains of sorrow and disappointment, of mental weariness and physical pain, have passed from them, and they have been cast into the sea of oblivion. If you will become possessed of this faith, you will not need to trouble about your future success or failure, and success will come. You will not need to become anxious about results, but will work joyfully and peacefully, knowing that right thoughts and right efforts will inevitably bring about the right results. And this is just exactly what Krishna told Arjuna. Knowing that the right thoughts and the right efforts will inevitably bring about right results. I know a lady who has entered into many blissful satisfactions, and recently a friend remarked to her, "Oh, how fortunate you are. You have to wish for a thing and it comes to you. You only have to wish for a thing and it comes to you." And it did indeed appear so on the surface. But in reality, all the blessedness that has entered into this woman's life is the direct outcome of the inward state of blessedness which she has throughout life been cultivating and training towards perfection. Mere wishing brings nothing but disappointment. It is living that tells. The foolish wish and grumble. The wise work and wait. And this woman had worked without and within, but especially with it upon heart and soul, and with the invisible hands of the Spirit she had built up with the precious stones of faith, hope, joy, devotion, and love, a fair temple of light, whose glorifying radiance was ever round about her. It beamed in her eye, it shone through her countenance, and it vibrated in her voice. And all who came into her presence felt its captivating spell. Reminds me of Mother. What a beautiful description. It beamed in her eye. It shone through her countenance. It vibrated in her voice, and all who came into her presence felt its captivating spell. And as with her, so with you. Your success, your failure, your influence, your whole life you carry about with you, for your dominant trends of thought are the determining factors in your destiny. Send forth loving, stainless, and happy thoughts, and blessings will fall into your hands, and your table will be spread with the cloth of peace. Send forth hateful, impure, and unhappy thoughts, and curses will rain down upon you, and fear and unrest will wait upon your pillow. You are the unconditional maker of your fate, be that fate what it may. Every moment you are sending forth from you influences which will make or mar your life. Let your heart grow large and loving and unselfish, and great and lasting will be your influence and success, even though you make little money. Confine it within the narrow limits of your self-interest, and even though you become a millionaire, your influence and success at the final reckoning will be found to be utterly insignificant. Cultivate, then, this pure and unselfish spirit, and combine it with purity and faith, singleness of purpose, and you are evolving from within the elements, and only of abounding health and enduring success, but of greatness and power. The secret of true power. If your present position is distasteful to you, and your heart is not in your work, nevertheless, perform your duties with scrupulous diligence, and while resting your mind in the idea that the better position and the greater opportunities are waiting for you, ever keep an active mental outlook for budding possibilities, so that when the critical moment arrives and the new channel presents itself, you will step into it with your mind fully prepared for the undertaking, and with that intelligence and foresight which is born of mental discipline. Whatever your task may be, concentrate your whole mind upon it. Throw it into all the energy of which you are capable. The faultless completion of small tasks lends inevitably to larger tasks. See to it that you rise by steady climbing and that you will never fall. And herein lies the secret of true power. Learn by constant practice how to conserve your resources and to concentrate them at any moment upon a given point. The foolish waste all their mental and spiritual energy in frivolity, foolish chatter, or selfish argument, not to mention wasteful physical excesses. If you would acquire overcoming power, you must cultivate poise and passivity. You must be able to stand alone. All power is associated with the immovability, the mountain, the massive rock, the storm-tried oak. All speak to us of power because of their combined solitary grandeur and defiant fixity, while the shifting sand, the yielding twig, and the waving reeds speak to us of weakness because they are immovable and non-resistant and are utterly useless when detached from their fellows. He or she is the person of power who, when all their fellows are swayed by some emotion or passion, remains calm and unmoved. He or she is only fitted to command and control who has succeeded in commanding and controlling themselves. This is the exact definition of a master. We talk about a spiritual master, and Mother often makes this point when she called Yoganandaji master. She said, it isn't that he's like a master and she's a slave. It's that he has mastered himself. And he has shown us this path, this righteous path that we can follow ourselves. So once again, he or she is the person of power who, when all their fellows are swayed by some emotion or passion, remains calm and unmoved. He or she only is fitted to command and control who has succeeded in commanding and controlling themselves. The hysterical, the fearful, the thoughtless, the frivolous, let such seek company or they will fall for lack of support. But the calm, the fearless, the thoughtful, and grave, let such seek the solitude of the forest, the desert, and the mountaintop, and to their power, more power will be added, and they will more and more successfully stem the psychic currents and whirlpools which engulf humankind. And once again, this is something that Master says. He said, the price of divinity, the price of upliftment is solitude. And this is what James Allen is telling us. Let such seek the solitude of the forest, the desert, and the mountaintop, and to their power, more power will be added, and they will more and more successfully stem the psychic currents and whirlpools which engulf humankind. Passion is not power. It is the abuse of power, the dispersion of power. Passion is like a furious storm which beats fiercely and wildly upon the embattled rock, while power is like the rock itself, which remains silent and unmoved through it all. That was a manifestation of true power when Martin Luther, wearied with the persuasions of his fearful friends, who were doubtful as to his safety, should he go to Worms, replied, if there were as many devils and worms as there are tiles in the housetops, I would go. The man had faith. And when Benjamin Disraeli broke down in his first parliamentary speech and brought upon himself the derision of the House, that was an exhibition of germinal power when he exclaimed, the day will come when you will consider it an honor to listen to me. When that young man, who I knew, passing through continual reverses and misfortunes, was mocked by friends and told to desist from further effort, and he replied, the time is not far distant when you will marvel at my good fortune and success, he showed that he was possessed of that silent and irresistible power which has taken him over innumerable difficulties and crowned his life with success. If you have not this power, you may acquire it by practice, and the beginning of power is likewise the beginning of wisdom. You must commence by overcoming these purposeless trivialities which you have hitherto been falling a willing victim. Boisterous and uncontrolled laughter, slandered and idle talk, and joking merely to raise a laugh, all these things must be put on one side as so much waste of valuable energy. St. Paul never showed his wonderful insight into the hidden laws of human progress to greater advantage than when he warned the Ephesians against foolish talking and jesting, which is not convenient. For to dwell habitually in such practices is to destroy all spiritual power and life. As you succeed in rendering yourself impervious to such mental dissipations, you will begin to understand what true power is, and you will then commence to grapple with the more powerful desires and appetites which hold your soul in bondage and bar the way to power, and your further progress will then be made clear. And this is another point that both Mother and Master and David has made, and that is single-mindedness is power. Much of our progress on the spiritual path has to do with our ability to concentrate. We most often see this in meditation, but also during our workday and as we go through life, our ability to put our minds on God, our ability to go within even during a busy day and during activity and try and determine what God's path is for us. That small, gentle voice informing us of which way to go and what to do. And that very much has to do with single-mindedness, the ability to focus, to concentrate. Above all, be of single aim, have a legitimate and useful purpose, and devote yourself unreservedly to it. Let nothing draw you aside. Remember that the double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. Be eager to learn, but slow to beg. Have a thorough understanding of your work, and let it be your own. As you proceed, ever following the inward guide, and once again, guide is capitalized. He's talking about the divine inward guide, God. The infallible voice, you will pass on from victory to victory, and you will rise step by step to higher resting places, and your ever-broadening outlook will gradually reveal to you the essential beauty and purpose of life. Self-purified health will be yours, self-governed power will be yours, and all that you do, you will prosper. For causing, ceasing to be a disjointed unit, self-enslaved, you will be in harmony with the great law, working no longer against but with the universal life, the eternal good. And what health you gain, it will remain with you. What success you achieve will be beyond all human computation and will never pass away. And what influence and power you wield will continue to increase throughout the ages, for it will be a part of that unchangeable principle which supports the universe. This, then, is the secret of health, a pure heart and a well-ordered mind. This is the secret of success, an unfaltering faith and a wisely directed purpose, and to rein in with unfaltering will the dark steed of desire. This is the secret of power. And now, the secret of abounding happiness. Great is the thirst for happiness, and equally great is the lack of happiness. The majority of the poor long for riches, believing that their possession would bring them supreme and lasting happiness. Many who are rich, having gratified every desire and whim, suffer from boredom and repletion, and are farther from the possession of happiness even than the very poor. If we reflect upon the state of things, it will ultimately lead us to a knowledge of the all-important truth that happiness is not derived from mere outward possessions, nor misery from the lack of them. For if this was so, we should find the poor always miserable, and the rich always happy, whereas the reverse is frequently the case. Some of the most wretched people whom I have known were those who were surrounded with riches and luxury, while some of the brightest and happiest people I have met were possessed of only the barest necessities of life. And I can't help but think of Papa on his pilgrimage around India. While some of the brightest and happiest people I have met were possessed of only the barest necessities of life. Many men who have accumulated riches have confessed that the selfish gratification which followed the acquisition of riches has robbed life of its sweetness, and that they were never so happy as when they were poor. What then is happiness, and how is it to be secured? Is it a figment, a delusion, and is suffering alone perennial? We shall find, after earnest observation and reflection, that all, except those who have entered the way of wisdom, believe that happiness is only to be attained by the gratification of desire. It is this belief, rooted in the soil of ignorance and continually watered by selfish cravings, that is the cause of all the misery in the world. And this we've heard before in various forms, that the root of suffering, the root of misery, is selfishness. And the irony is that we're selfish to try and bring ourselves happiness, to try and bring ourselves joy. But the conundrum, the paradox, is that the more selfish we are, the more miserable we become. And this is a truth that James Allen observed. And I do not limit the word desire to the grosser animal cravings. It extends to the higher psychic realm, where far more powerful, subtle, and insidious cravings hold in bondage the intellectual and refined, depriving them of all that beauty, harmony, and purity of soul whose expression is happiness. Most people will admit that selfishness is the cause of all the unhappiness in the world, but they fall under the soul-destroying delusion that it is someone else's selfishness and not their own. When you are willing to admit that all your unhappiness is the result of your own selfishness, you will not be far from the gates of paradise. But so long as you are convinced that it is the selfishness of others that is robbing you of joy, so long will you remain a prisoner in your self-created purgatory. Happiness is that inner state of perfect satisfaction which is joy and peace, and from all desire is eliminated. The satisfaction which results from gratified desire is brief and illusory, and is always followed by an increased demand for gratification. Desire is as insatiable as the ocean and clamors louder and louder as its demands are attended to. It claims ever-increasing service from its deluded devotees until at last they are struck down with physical or mental anguish and are hurled into the purifying fires of suffering. Desire is the region of hell, and all torments are centered there. The giving up of desire is the realization of heaven. I'm going to read that again. Desire is the region of hell, and all torments are centered there. The giving up of desire is the realization of heaven, and all delights await the pilgrim there. Now he's got a little poem. I spent my soul through the invisible, some letter of that afterlife to spell, and by my soul returned to me and whispered, I myself am heaven and hell. Heaven and hell are inward states. This is another truth that we've discovered since being on this path. Sometimes in conventional Christianity, traditional Christianity, it's taught that heaven and hell are places that you go after you die. But they're actually inner states of consciousness. And what James Allen is saying is that we cultivate these inner states of consciousness ourselves. And that's actually a very uplifting and inspiring idea that we can have control. We can set our sails. We can determine which way we go. So if we're unhappy, if we're full of anxiety, if we're distraught, we have it within our power to turn that ship around and go towards that which inspires us, to lifts us up, that which gives us peace and happiness. Heaven and hell are inward states. Sink into self. And when he says self, he means in this case the little self, selfishness. Sink into selfishness and all its gratifications, and you sink into hell. Rise above that state of consciousness, which is the utter denial and forgetfulness of your little self, and you enter heaven. Self is blind, without judgment, not possessed of true knowledge, and always leads to suffering. Correct perception, unbiased judgment, and true knowledge belong only to the divine state, and only insofar as you realize this divine consciousness can you know what real happiness is. So long as you persist in selfishly seeking for your own personal happiness, so long will happiness elude you, and you will be sowing the seeds of wretchedness. Insofar as you succeed in losing yourself in the service of others, in that measure will happiness come to you, and you will reap a harvest of bliss. It is in loving, not in being loved, the heart is blessed. It is in giving, not in seeking gifts, we find our quest. Whatever be thy longing or thy need, that do thou give. So shall thou be fed. So shall thou soul be fed, and thou indeed shalt truly live. Giving up to gain. Cling to self, and you cling to sorrow. Relinquish self, and you enter into peace. To seek selfishly is not only to lose happiness, but even that which we believe to be the source of happiness. See how the glutton is continually looking about for a new delicacy wherewith to stimulate his deadened appetite, and how bloated, burdened, and diseased, scarcely any food, at last is eaten with pleasure. Whereas he who has mastered his appetite and does not seek but never thinks of gustatory pleasure, finds delight in the most frugal meal. The angel form of happiness, which men looking through the eyes of self imagine they see in gratified desire, when embraced, is always found to be the skeleton of misery. Truly, he that seeketh his life shall lose it, and he that loses his life shall find it. Once again from the Bible. Abiding happiness will come to you when ceasing to selfishly cling. You are willing to give up. When you are willing to lose unreservedly that impermanent thing which is so dear to you, and which, whether you cling to it or not, will one day be snatched from you, then you will find what seemed to you like a painful loss turns out to be a supreme gain. To gain, to give up in order to gain, to be willing to yield up and to suffer loss, this indeed is the way of life. How is it possible to find real happiness by centering ourselves in those things which by their nature must pass away? Abiding in real happiness can only be found by centering ourselves in that which is permanent. And what's permanent is the spirit. That is what we get to take with us. Rise, therefore, above the clinging and to the cravings for impertinent things, and you will then enter into a consciousness of the eternal, and as rising above the self and by growing more and more in the spirit of purity, self-sacrifice and universal love, you become centered in that consciousness, you will realize that happiness, which has no reaction and which can never be taken from you. In other words, you're not happy based on something that just happened to you or an external circumstance. You have a happiness when centered in the spirit that no one can take away. The heart has reached utter self-forgetfulness in its love for others, has not only become possessed of the highest happiness, but it has entered into immortality, for it has realized the divine. Look back upon your life and you will find that the moments of supremest happiness were those in which you uttered some word or performed some act of compassion or self-denying love. Spirituality, happiness, and harmony are synonymous. Harmony is one phrase of the great law whose spiritual expression is love. All selfishness is discord, and to be selfish is to be out of harmony with the divine order. As we realize that all-embracing love, which is a negation of self, we put ourselves in harmony with the divine music, the universal song, and that ineffable melody. True happiness becomes our own. Men and women are rushing hither and thither in the blind search for happiness and cannot find it, nor ever will, until they recognize that happiness is already within them and round about them, filling the universe, and that they, in their selfish searching, are shuttering themselves from it. And he writes a little poem here called The Secret of Happiness. I followed happiness to make her mind, past towering oak and swinging vine. She fled, I chased, over slanting hill and dale, over fields and meadows in the purpling vale. Pursuing rapidly over dashing stream, I scaled the dizzy cliffs where eagles scream. I traversed swiftly over land and sea, but always happiness eluded me. Exhausted, fainting, I pursued no more, but sank to rest upon the barren shore. One came and asked for food, and one for alms. I placed the bread and gold in bony palms. One came for sympathy, and one for rest. I shared with every needy one my best. When lo, sweet happiness, with form divine, stood by me, whispering softly, I am thine. So selfishness is the path to misery. Divine service is the path to divinity. So we've come to the point where we're moving to the last little chapter in As a Man Thinketh. So with this little chapter, this few pages, we're going to finish the book that we started. And the name of this last chapter is called Serenity. Calmness of mind is one of the beautiful jewels of wisdom. It is the result of long and patient effort and self-control. Its presence is an indication of ripened experience and of a more than ordinary knowledge of the laws and operations of thought. A man becomes calm in the measure that he understands himself as a thought-evolved being, for such knowledge necessitates the understanding of others as the result of thought. And as he develops a right understanding and sees more and more clearly the internal relations of things by the action of cause and effect, he ceases to fuss and fume and worry and grieve and remains poised, steadfast, and serene. The calm man, having learned how to govern himself, knows how to adapt himself to others, and they in turn revere his spiritual strength and feel that they can learn of him and rely upon him. The more tranquil a man becomes, the greater is his success, his influence, his power for good. Even the ordinary businessman will find his business prosperity increase as he develops a far greater self-control and equanimity, for people always prefer to deal with a man whose behavior is strongly serene. The strong, calm man is always loved and revered. He is like a shade-giving tree in a thirsty land or a sheltering rock in a storm. Who does not love a tranquil heart, a sweet-tempered, balanced life? It does not matter whether it rains or shines, or what changes come to those possessing these blessings, for they are always sweet, serene, and calm. The exquisite poise of character, which we call serenity, is the last lesson of culture. It is the flowering of life, the fruitage of the soul. It is precious as wisdom, more to be desired than gold, yea, than even fine gold. How insignificant money-seeking looks in comparison with a serene life, a life that dwells in the ocean of truth, beneath the waves, beyond the reach of tempests, in the eternal calm. How many people we know who sour their lives, who ruin all that is sweet and beautiful by explosive tempers, who destroy their poise of character and make bad blood. It is a question of whether or not the great majority of people do not ruin their lives and mar their happiness by lack of self-control. How few people we meet in life who are well-balanced, who have that exquisite poise which is characteristic of the finished character. Yes, humanity surges with uncontrolled passion, is tumultuous with ungoverned grief, is blown about by anxiety and doubt. Only the wise man, only he whose thoughts are controlled and purified, makes the winds and storms of the soul obey him. Tempest-tossed souls, wherever you may be, under whatsoever conditions you may live, know this. In the ocean of life, the isles of blessedness are smiling, and the sunny shore of your ideal awaits your coming. Keep your hand firmly upon the helm of thought. In the ship of your soul reclines the commanding master. And of course, this is our inner divine guidance, the commanding master. He does but sleep. Wake him. Self-control is strength. Right thought is mastery. Calmness is power. Say unto your heart, peace, be still. And with that, we've concluded the entire book with a nice bonus on the secret to prosperity and health and happiness. So at this point, I would like to open it up. If you've got some observations about this, we've just gone over quite a bit, quite a few thoughts and ideals and ways to go through life. We've talked about faith. We've talked about keeping your thoughts on the highest. We've talked about the pursuit of happiness and how oftentimes happiness comes in the sincere service to others and not as expecting a big thank you or any notoriety, but just in the joy that that service brings us. And I've noticed that this seems to be the hallmark of an uplifted soul. And you can see this when you go to the ashram. And so many there work so hard to make your life better, to provide for you, to make things nice for you, so that you can have a good experience. We see it in the service to others that David gave us, just constant. It was unending, a tireless service that Mother gave. Mother would talk about being up, talking to somebody in the wee hours of the morning, trying to help them through a situation. David talked about working in the astral all night, helping those of us that needed a problem solved or some guidance. So this service is to others in a sincere and loving way is one of the most wonderful paths to divine happiness. So there's been many truths revealed here. And do you have any observations that you can unmute yourself? We can talk about this for a moment. If you've got something that you've observed, some parallel between our own teachings and what he was able to observe on his own.
I liked Peter that he came to the understanding, and I don't remember his phrasing, but the idea of as you give, so shall you receive. So to render the services that you want rendered to you, or the gifts that you want given to you, that you give those first.
Yes, it's such a such a wonderful and uplifted truth. You know, I see sometimes this quote from Gandhi is be the change that you want to see in the world. And that's kind of a parallel for that. If you want to see more kindness, be kind. If you want to see more generosity, be generous. If you want to feel and experience more love and service, provide love and service. And you're so correct. You know, they say that a recipe for depression or feeling anxiety or feeling separate is to find some area where you can serve. You know, they say perhaps volunteer at a hospital, you know, help people that need it. And you do some of that for a while and you find that much of your own anxiety or depression or angst or sadness goes away. It's a wonderful path towards peace. And when we do this, we provide a great service to the world. That's one of the things I've always observed at the farm. You know, when you go there, they're so happy to serve and they're so sweet. And I just think, gosh, I want to be like this, you know, the greatest example. I think the greatest ministries are ministries by example. Yeah. Hard to deny.
It's the only true ministry, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. It really is. Although I have to admit, I certainly enjoyed David's talks and still do, and Mother's talks. I mean, quite inspiring.
But because they lived it.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And you can feel the truth of their words, can't you, when you listen to them? And you feel that power. You know, in the beginning, go ahead.
One thing that, you know, I work in a situation where I'm giving service quite a bit to people that need it, and so is everyone around me. And then within all that, there's, you know, glitches and communication and things that sometimes my little self can get kind of annoyed with. And thinking it should be different, you know. And then God has come in and said, well, what if you were at the ashram? You know, like, kind of like, consider this to be your ashram. So if this happened at the ashram, would you be annoyed? And it's like, no, of course not. because when so many people are, like, putting on an event or doing an activity, then there's bound to be, you know, someone, you know, in someone else's space, or, you know, little misunderstandings. But in the scheme of things, you know, we're doing great work and the residents enjoy a lot of the things that we're putting on, and, you know, but so that's just, and so once I'm in the middle of doing something, like we had a karaoke for the residents on mm-hmm. Saturday, and it's kind of hard to go around and hold the microphone for, you know, each one, and, you know, being in a weird position and bending over. But there was so much joy in that moment of just where they were singing the words to an old song that they remembered that's up on the screen, and even the ones who said they weren't going to sing ended up singing for something. We had a computer problem at the beginning, so we got a little flustered. And then once we got it going, then there was so much joy and fun that it just took away all that anxiety from the computer glitch.
You know, Michelle, I always thought you were in such a fantastic position to bring divine light into where you work and bring some upliftment to those who you work with. And I know you do a very sincere, very good job doing that. And I just thought, what a blessing your work is to you and to those that you serve.
Today I had a kind of negative thing where I became very impatient, and I was like, wow, this isn't pleasant to admit that I'm very impatient sometimes, and it's not a good quality. We were on this bus, and I just wanted the guy to take us back to the center. But no, we had to pick up two other people first and drive all over Linden. And
well,
I was like,
I mean, look at
we're
all
kind
these
of hungry. Can you take us first? And he was like, no, I can't. And I was like, I have so much work to do. I was really not a very nice person to this bus driver. And then I heard myself and I was like, oh man, I'm just going to shut my mouth now. But yeah, it was God was showing me an unlovely quality that I need to work on.
Yeah. You have so many wonderful opportunities to, you know, to try and be better and to try and serve better. And when you observe things that, you know, you're not too happy with yourself, you know, you can say, okay, God, you know, I'm going to try better. I just think you're in such a good position to do this.
Oh yeah, I have so many opportunities.
it's quite wonderful to hear about. And you know, I know this when you keep your mind on God and when you want to serve in that way, I know you're bringing some light to those people there. And I think that's really important.
I do.
It's delightful. Anyone else have any observations about what we've just gone over, what we've learned? One of the things I think about is in the beginning of our reading tonight, he spent some time talking about power and where true power comes from. And it's this calm, immutable faith and belief in what you know to be true. And no matter what's going on around you or how many people think differently, you stick steadfastly to that. And for us, that's that focus on God and that focus on the highest light. And I don't think I've ever seen a better example of that in my entire life than with Mother Hamilton. And when you listen to a talk of hers, she speaks with such absolute, utter conviction. And, you know, she used to say, I will speak the truth and I will let the chips fall where they may. And if you were around her at all, you knew that to be the case. If she saw something, she would say it right then and there. And, you know, the world can do what it wants with that. And you can really tell that that's a big part of her personality when you listen to her talks. There's just absolute, utter power and conviction. And you could feel that emanating from her from a mile away. And it created this magnetic attraction for everybody that came within her sphere. You could not help it. You knew you were standing in the presence of power. And one of the wonderful boons of this is you understood that with this person on your side, you didn't have too much to worry about. She was so powerful. She had the ability to let us jump right on her coattails and take that ride to God. And I would say that David had that same power. And of course, Master did too. But with Mother, when she speaks, it was just so evident. It was so strong. Anything else? Any other observations? I want you to have a chance to share a bit if you would like to.
I think it was just so nice to have it in different words from a different era.
Right.
So it was lots of joy in that way and you did a lovely job of reading and articulating along the way. So thank you, Peter.
Oh, you're very welcome. My pleasure. You know, do you notice when somebody comes upon these truths, these universal truths, whether it be David or Mother or Master or someone outside, or whether it be James Allen, there are those that hear that and they think, yes, that's the truth. That resonates. So without really soliciting or seeking, he had a group of souls around him that would come in the evening and sit, and they would discourse on these truths. I just think that's so fascinating. You know, in the Bible, they say the sheep know the shepherd's voice. And I think that's true for all of us, too. I mean, why are we here? There's something that we were exposed to with a talk or meeting David or meeting Mother where we just, it resonated with us. And we said, yeah, that's the truth. I want to know more. I want to find out what all this is about. So you're right, Greg. It is fun to see this, these truths disseminated in a slightly different way from a different era with a little bit different language, but they're just saying exactly what we know to be true. And it's really, it's sort of confirming and validating for us. It's wonderful. Anyone else before we close? I just want to say that this is in a tradition that Mother started way back when. If you listen to her talk this last Sunday, she actually started off by talking about taking a little break in the summer. And we obviously haven't taken a break for the summer, but here coming up in August, everyone has so many things to do. Many are traveling. There's things going on. So we're going to take a little break from regular services, from Wednesday night services and from Sunday services for the month of August. And we'll return right at the beginning of September. For the next two Mondays, I'm going to have service here at the house, and we're going to have that with Zoom as well. So I'll send out the regular email and the link. And then on the 15th, I'm going to the farm for 2 weeks. And I don't come home until I get home at the very last day of August, and then we'll be back. And so during those 2 weeks, just depending on what the connections are there and what's able to be done, I will probably be taking a sabbatical as well. So I just wanted you to know what the upcoming schedule is. And in Mother's words, when she talked about it in this talk we just listened to, you know, she said, take this opportunity, take these truths and work with them yourself and find that inner meaning within yourself and really concentrate and take this time to make some progress and never be idle in our pursuit of the divine. So this is something that we can do. We can encourage each other to do, and we can really go within and make this a time of progress. So in that context, it's so special to be with you tonight and for us to be here. It's a delightful, the highest reason to come together. And I think we all help each other on our path by being here and putting our focus on God. So with those thoughts in mind, please pray with me. Oh, Heavenly Father.
Oh, Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
I feel the wonder and the beauty of thy glorious presence in every part of my being.
I feel the wonder and the beauty of thy glorious presence in every part of my being.
My heart is bursting with my love for thee.
My heart is bursting with my love for thee.
I feel the power of thy perfection surging in every cell of my body.
I feel the power of thy perfection surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence are radiant with thy healing light.
My mind and my intelligence are radiant with thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with thee.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with thee.
I and my Father are one.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Oh. 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 Bliss.
Bliss.
Amen.
Amen.
Mm. May God bless you and keep you until we meet again.